all you Metsian folk out there. This is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell. And you know what? Sometimes that song just takes me over. And considering since Edwin Diaz blew the save, I've just been basically jamming out to as much feel-good music as possible. Shout out to Adam Spiegel for our Metsian theme, the 80s themed from my Mets fan documentary, but we can get into that in shameless plugs at another time. Let's get right into the Mets theme podcast. Thank you all for joining us. Before we get to the show, I just want to say thank you for all of you out there listening right now. And if this is the first time that you are listening, make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or wherever you can find podcasts. And if you can't find us on that podcast platform, make sure we know about it so we can get that podcast on there, that platform that you are listening to. Without further ado, we have so much to get into. Let me go down to Brooklyn, Bensonhurst, Michael Colon. Mike, what a weird week since the last time we talked. It's regular time in Metsville, right?
Indeed. You know, the Stems are back to their old tricks again. So here we are. Lots to discuss on and off the field, obviously.
So before we have Rich Sparago, who will be joining us, it's draft night. You know, I think we are allowed to disclaim that, but he will be joining in progress. Mike, where do you want to begin with everything? You know, we basically ended last week with Bugate. It was an off day. It was in between everything. And it was before the Mets doubleheader that before the apologies of Francisco Lindor and Javi Baez, and before both of them had just been tearing the cover off the ball over the last week. There's been a lot of emotions, a regular week in Metsville. Where do you want to begin?
We'll start right there. You know, again, we're coming off the week of Boo Gate, if you want to call it that. And, you know, the thing is, they won six in a row. And instead of fattening their position in the standings, you know, we're just trying to recoup what we lost against the Dodgers and the Giants, unfortunately. So we should be talking about, you know, that surge of six wins in a row, but we're not. Unfortunately, we have today's dilemma, Edwin Diaz and that blown save. I mean, you know as well as I, as well as all baseball fans, when you walk the leadoff batter, what's the percentage that that runner is going to score, much less walking two
right.
batters? You know, so things were bound to go awry. His second blown save. The Mets, it's funny, you know, if we were haggling over this back in April saying that the Mets would be four games out of first place, you know, after the first week of September, a lot of people would subscribe to that, you know, and say, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take my chances. But as you say, you know, there's context to this. And today really hurt. Today really hurt. Otherwise,
yeah,
you know, for the most part, they're doing what they have to do, which is get through these games with Washington and Miami. We took, three out of five from Washington. You know, we're coming off that sweep of Miami. We're going back to Miami. You know, we still got work to do. Their problem is they're so out of sync, and they've been out of sync all season. You know, in the early part of the season, it was pitching and the bench mob because of all the injuries. And now that the hitting is carrying the pitching, our bullpen falters. You know, bullpen starting pitching, hitting, they've had a hard time syncing up, you know, through these first, let's call it 5.5 months of the season. The only thing that they've done with any great consistency this season is field. You know, they've done very well. As a matter of fact, they talked about it today on the telecast, where I believe they're fourth in Major League Baseball with 52 defensive runs saved. You know, so that's about all they've done, you know, with any consistency this season. when the hitting's off, the pitching's on. When the starting pitching's going, the bullpen falters. When the starting pitching falters, the bullpen falters. You know, and they need to get all three of these things in sync, and they need to do it pronto.
Pronto, I think, is an understatement, but there's so much to unpack. So let's start with today. And the stat we saw after the game was that this was Edwin Diaz's 17th blown save in three seasons with the team. Obviously, that becomes a 60-game season with 2020. But the fact that that can be included, you know, makes it even worse when you really think about it. Anybody who's pointing that out can also, you know, the detractors can also, I think, go from that angle. So with those numbers and the idea that, okay, maybe he's gotten better, but these are still happening and against the worst teams. And I'll get into the idea of you know, the worst teams. My personal opinion, and I'll just, I guess, say as a blanket nutshell statement, is you have to win whatever's been presented to you in the day that you're facing a team, regardless of what the opponent is. So I don't want to hear that they, you know, oh, God, look at how awful they are. They're blowing games against the Nationals, but at the same time, you never want to accept the wins. None of those people who are talking about how it's pitiful that they're blowing these games are not giving them any credit for wins. A W is equal at the end of the year, and that's the bottom line. There's no point system we're talking about here. Anyway, I digress. Going to today, let's start today. 17 blown saves in three seasons. How can you live with that down a playoff stretch? How can you live with that in the playoffs? I think one way or another, if the Mets miss the playoffs, the Mets will have missed the playoffs the entire time they have had Edwin Diaz as their quote-unquote premier closer. Where do you begin?
It starts and ends with the roll of the dice. What are you going to do, bench him? You can't do that. You have to put him out there, whether you use him in the seventh, eighth, or ninth. He has to pitch. And he has to stay in the rotation, pitch regularly. And we just have to sit back and hope for the best. That's all we can do. That's all the Mets can do. That's all Luis Rojas can do. Is just keep sending him out there and hoping for the best.
Let's go bigger picture then. Where, you know, obviously I guess that a lot of things that we discuss are going to be incomplete. A lot of things that we discuss are going to be left to whatever the storyline comes in either the next few days or the next 2 to 3 weeks, or longer, hopefully. But, like, there's a lot, again, going back to what you said, what I said about the context. So, if the Mets win the World Series, great. Let's say the Mets win the World Series and everything is redeemed. Can you still just live in that world with Edwin Diaz? Let's say they don't. Do you automatically go a different direction?
I think he, like everyone else on this roster and front office for that matter, will be under review come end of season. His role on this team has to be revisited. You know, the rate of success isn't up to snuff. Or maybe it is, if you want to argue that. If you want to argue, you know, his saves and a three and change, what's his ERA? I think 3.65. You know, for a reliever, when you're dealing with one inning at a time, 1.2 innings at a time, you know, when you pitch incrementally like that, the ERA fluctuates drastically. You know, so at face value, you might think it's high, but, you know. But the problem is blown saves. And how trustworthy is he? And that's up to Luis Rojas to decide when, in what situation will he utilize him. It may not be in the closer situation. he might be asked to put out a fire in the eighth inning, or the seventh inning for that matter. And Luis Rojas might have to turn to Jerry Familia or Trevor May or someone else. You know, he's going to have to reconfigure his bullpen. He's going to have to be a little bit more imaginative down the stretch. But again, I will reiterate, you, I, Rojas, the Mets, the team, they have no choice but to keep putting him out there and letting him pitch and just hoping for the best. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. Everyone's up for review at the end of the season. Here's the problem. Again, we're only four games out, so we're in the thick of it. That's a good thing. But when you're only one game above 500, you only have, fractionally more positive things to talk about than negative. And I do mean fractionally. So there's an equal amount of both. We could take this in either direction, and be justified by their performance. So it's up to them, like I said, to get this thing in sync. The hitting, the starting pitching, and the bullpen needs to, perform effectively together for a change. Because throughout the season, it's been 2 out of 3. And in this instance, unlike Meatloaf says, 2 out of 3 is bad.
Well, I'll before we get into the breakdown of the last week, I will say this. Anytime I get to the chance to watch the Braves, whether it's when the Mets face them or just recently against the Rockies, it would appear on just face value the Braves look like they're a better team than the Mets currently concoct. And I guess where it really grows tiresome is that any time the Mets are presented, it do seem like on any given year they could be the better team. But it always seems like it needs to take a miracle. Obviously, that's kind of what the Mets have gone for a long time. But when looking at the three teams that are currently as tied up as the Mets, the Phillies, and the Braves are, where are you on all of this?
Well, here's an instance where the numbers speak for themselves. Look at the Braves, compare them to the Mets. Look at the Braves. Freddie Freeman, he's going to break 30 home runs this season. All right, Alonso has 30 home runs. But what about the rest of the team? The Braves have Albies with 26 home runs. Swanson, 26 home runs. Riley, 29 home runs. All of them with 80 or more runs batted in. Do the Mets have that? No. We know how woeful they've been on offense this season. And right now, Bryce Harper with Philadelphia is just on a tear. The man is hotter than the sun, and that's what they pay for. He's giving them what they pay for, star power. And he's carrying them right now. Who's carrying the Mets right now? Again, one game over 500, so we could take this in either direction. There's an equal amount of good and bad to discuss here. What direction are they taking? And again, if you want to compare them to the Braves and the Phillies, well, cup half full, half empty. Whereas the Mets were riding on top of the division for the majority of the season, the Phillies and the Braves were floundering under 500. And now the tables have turned. But the Mets are a good team, and they're still in the thick. And, their priority needs to be making those games against the Phillies and the Braves at the end of the season matter.
Well, they're basically one game from doing this. They enter, if the Braves are still in first place, they enter that series four games behind with three games to play. Obviously, that doesn't matter. But without further ado, live from what I assume is Connecticut, we bring on Rich Spirago. Rich, death, taxes, and the Nationals walking off on the Mets.
Yeah. you know, there are, I caught a little bit of what you were saying there, and about, you know, I assume, Mike, you were talking about the Phillies and Bryce Harper, but you know, about the walk-off today, you know, there are two very distinct ways to look at that. You know, everybody was talking about the 14 games they had against the Nationals and the Marlins, and so you could say they're 8-3 in the first 11. So that's really good. I mean, it's good. It is good. And but it's good with a with an asterisk, because you know, the walk off today, I mean, you can't let that happen. You know, you need every game. You especially need the games against the teams you're supposed to beat, like the Nationals. And it's just it's a gut punch, you know, and let's see how resilient they are. But yeah, the walk off today was just, I don't know if you guys smelled it coming. I did. I thought they were lucky to get out of the inning, you know, when Lugo got out in the eighth. And then, like Todd Zeal said in the postgame, and like I've said on this podcast, with Diaz, you could tell, at least I think I could tell, in his first pitch or two, if he's on or off, and you knew he was off today. You just knew it. You know, he threw the slider. It stayed to the arm side. It, you know, his slider is supposed to break, start in the middle of the strike zone and end up, you know, low and away to a right-hander, low and in on the left-hander. And it stayed up on the throwing hand side, you know, never caught the plate. It started outside and stayed outside, which meant he didn't have command of it. And he just knew right away it was going to be, I don't know about you guys, but to me, the first two pitches, I'm like, they're not winning this game. And unfortunately they didn't. And they don't have, you know, it's not June anymore. They don't have time. And they really need to win every game. Think about it. Everybody says, you know, if they're within three games, they go to Atlanta, at least they have a chance. Well, if they had won today, they would have been three games out. Now they have to get there. And they have to get there, and I'm sure we're going to get into the competition they have coming. So that's my thought.
Yeah, you know, and we will certainly bookend with what's to come. I will start here. Both games in this five-game set of the Nationals, both games that they lost 4-3. This one they happened to do in devastating fashion. And as I was saying, Rich, before you came on air, I was saying it to Mike, the baseball gods give us, the baseball gods take us away. If we're going to start, and I'm actually really happy that you came on before we got into a full discussion since the last time that we talked about all of this stuff before the apologies. The Mets had no business losing today's game, and the Mets had no business winning the game against the Marlins after the apologies with Francisco Lindor and Javi Baez. And, Rich, I'm going to start with you. In terms of talking about the full crazy, like I told Mike before you got on the air, regular week in Mets fashion, that's how this basically started. That was the last time that we talked. Where are you since the last time we talked on all of that? Did we lose Rich?
I'm muted. I'm back on.
Man! Listen. We're gonna have just like Mets Booth has a dollar in the jar. All right, you guys. It's gonna start now. Okay, dollar in the jar.
Yeah. No,
I know. I've already got it half full myself. So.
All right. So, where am I with the whole thing? Well, all right. Let's start with Boogate. We'll call it. I didn't like the way that went down, honestly, and I mean the apology. And I'll tell you what bothered me. I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but I watched Lindor and Baez have to stand in front of the media and apologize to the best of their ability. I mean, they didn't come out and throw themselves on their swords, but they did apologize. Well, Kevin Pillar was doing it too. I didn't see Pillar apologize to anybody. And if you did, then you were one up on me because I didn't see it. And I have a problem with that. And I'm not suggesting, you know, ethnicity or anything like that. I don't know what the hell it is. I don't like the fact that three guys, you could find video of three guys doing a thumbs down, two guys apologize. What the hell is that? And all right, that's the first thing I had a problem with. And then, you know, so And then Steve Cohen, who I think is awesome. I really do. I love the fact that a fan owns the team, and he kind of acts like we do. And I think that's kind of fun. But I don't like the fact that he trolled the fans back on Twitter. He said, you know, after Baez had the good game, he said, where are all the Baez detractors? He goes, they must have all gone away for the holiday weekend. And, you know, and he's kind of doing it too. How is that different? He's taking shots at his customers. So it's okay for him to do it, but it's not okay for his players to do it. And when his players do it, only two of the three of them apologize? I mean, I don't know. But, okay, that said, I'll let you guys comment on all that. The play on the field, that win on Tuesday in the first game of doubleheader was one for the ages. And so I love the fact that, you know, that they're hot right now. Is it too little too late? We will find out. The other thought I have, and I'll turn, you know, before I finish, is that in the past week, we have seen everything Javi Baez can do. You know, and it's like I believe it was Todd Diehl said, the team lacks or seems to lack that, you know, that swagger, speed, athleticism. Baez is all of it. And anybody who thinks he shouldn't be back, now I know money's a real thing, and we'll see what he – you want to bring Stroman back, you want to bring Baez back. We'll see how that factors in. But taking money off the table, this man's skills, what he does, what he could bring to a team, yes, you have to tolerate the strikeouts to get there, the athleticism, the speed, everything he brings to the team, how can you not want this guy back? And I think over – you know, while he had some stutter steps in the beginning, I think over the last week we've truly seen what an elite athlete this guy is, and I want him on the team. So those are my observations.
And I think we'll go with the Javi Baez direction here. You know, that's basically where this 6-5 starts, but like Rich says, where's Kevin Pillar to be the third person to apologize? But I guess the idea seemed to be that it started with Javier Baez and Francisco Lindor. That doesn't mean that Kevin Pillar shouldn't have been there up front, but I think that this is a week since this entire thing started, and you are a Mets fan having watched Javi Baez with this basically New York manufactured thing that Cub fans, if you talk to them, never had to deal with. Javi Baez never seemed to have to deal with. And that's for better or worse, as we discussed in the last podcast. However, here he is immediately just being like, well, I'm going to play the best week I've played for this team so far. Go ahead, Mike. Well, I'm not going to say anything else.
You're muted, Mike.
Dollar in the jaw. Ka-ching. Rich, that's a fresh opinion. I haven't thought of it like that at all. To me, this struck me as typical damage control. Baez and Lindor got slapped on the wrist by, you know, the corporate leaders. And we're told to apologize. Baez was the one who was vocal about it. Lindor was supposedly the instigator. And that's why those two were made to go out and speak to the media and no one else. That struck me as typical by the book. I never brought that third party into the equation like you did. And I find that terribly interesting. Insofar as the tweets, I don't really care, and maybe that's why I don't have an opinion, but, you know, your opinion, again, Rich, has got me thinking. Just a fresh opinion, and I've never really thought about it like that, because you're right. He's trolling the fans, just the way we got trolled by Baez. Very interesting. The only thing I'll throw into this, like a hockey stick into the spokes, is Robinson Cano returns next year. And he brings with him a heavy price tag. I don't know how he's going to complicate matters insofar as, you know, retaining players, acquiring players, and paying for players. But it will be interesting nonetheless. Baez, I have no problems if they resign him. If, you know, if it's agreeable to all parties, fine. You know, I'm just against. I'm against Lindor's contract. To me, it's too long. I'm against those long-term contracts. I'm against those long-term commitments because I like flexibility. You know, I'm not begrudging the business. I just like, I prefer having the organizational flexibility, you know, that shorter-term contracts allow. That's all.
Yeah, you know, I can imagine. And, Rich, you know, I was going to go in a different direction, but I'll start here in terms of those contracts and Francisco Lindor in particular. Regardless of how the rest of the season winds up, and like we're going to get into, and why don't we get into it partially now, Francisco Lindor has been hitting the cover off the ball, whether it's an out or a hit lately. Would you, you know, Beltran is, Carlos Beltran is, in terms of the relationship going forward with this franchise, is going to be an interesting conversation. But in terms of the Francisco Lindor thing, would you want to get the two in contact considering the, you know, and Lindor's average is probably not going to settle where Beltran's ended up, but that still, I think, would be a good conversation to have in the offseason. Wouldn't you agree?
I do agree. And I think that if Luis Rojas is not retained, I mean, I don't know what the status of that is, but, you know, look at it like this. Cora has a job. AJ Hinch has a job. I don't know if Carlos Beltran would want to manage at this point. He certainly did, you know, going into the 2020 season. I'm not sure where he is in his life, you know, if it's something he might want to do or not. But when you think about it, I mean, come on. It makes all the sense in the world. You've invested $341 million in Francisco Lindor over the next 10 seasons. Beltran, it's a great analogy, you know, went through the same thing, adjusting to New York after having played in Houston and Kansas City. And, you know, and he had to go through all that. So not only would it be a wonderful thing, Beltran is one of the most talented Mets to ever put on the uniform. You know, you could bring him back. He's done his time, of course, if he wants to. But also, you'd be bringing him into a situation where your franchise player, I'd have to think, could relate to him because they went through the same thing. And you'd almost be, in a strange sort of a way, accommodating the guy you basically dubbed your franchise player, not your franchise pitcher, who, of course, is DeGrom, but your franchise position player. You'd be bringing a manager who is probably incredibly qualified, you know, his knowledge of the game, but also one who can relate to the struggle of your 10-year, $341 million man. So, yeah, absolutely. Put them in touch. Yeah, I'd like to see Beltran run the damn show, for God's sakes. Honestly, I would, you know. So I think he'd be great. I mean, he's got Mets pedigree. I think the fans would eat him up. I think in a good way. I mean, I think they would love having him in, you know, back in the uniform. I think we felt that way when he was hired in November of 2019. You know, that it was great to see that he has, you know, had mended fences with the Mets, was going to come back and wear the Mets uniform. So long way of saying, should they be in touch? Of course. Would it be fantastic, in my opinion, if Beltran were interested to put him in the dugout? Abso-freaking-lutely.
You are listening to the Metsian podcast as we get to the half-hour mark. And Mike, what's so interesting where Rich went with that, because you know, I was just talking about a conversation, but Rich, considering the unsteady ground that is probably near a potential epicenter, near a couple fault lines for Luis Rojas right now, is currently the situation. A lot depends on how this season goes, especially, you know, I think you could even say how they play, even if they don't make the playoffs. You know, it's gonna be an interesting analysis going forward. But Where are you? Everything, both I presented as well as Rich.
Everything is up for review. We are no longer owned by the Wilpons, even though they still have 5%. But, you know, Steve Cohen owns the Mets now. Therefore, my expectations and my demands have changed. You know, Beltran, under the Wilpons, I entertained that idea. I was okay with it. Now that we are under ownership of the Cohens, or I should say Mr. Cohen, I will no longer entertain that idea. Because I have to ask, is that the best we can do? And I'll struggle with that. I'm torn, you know, with potentially bringing Carlos Beltran back. But everyone is up for review. And again, I think Steve Cohen has something more in store for this organization. I think he's just been trying to get his foot into the door, get acclimated, you know, get comfortable in his chair. But, you know, I do think there's more in store. I do think there'll be an overhaul in this front office, or at least I hope there is an overhaul in this front office. But I'll cycle back, and I'll end it with what I said, is that with Mr. Cohen, I have different demands and expectations. These are conversations we had under the Wilpons, and under them, you know, we were forced to think out of the box because nothing else they did ever worked, you know, or at least, not, you know, 98% of the time they didn't work. So we had to entertain such nonsense and folly. But we're no longer in that position, or at least I don't think we are, not under this ownership. My expectations have changed, but I'm giving him time and space to get acclimated and learn how to go about, you know, being an effective owner. And perhaps that starts this off season, you know, but I really had no high expectations, unlike the expectations that, you know, he put forth in the press conference that I'd be disappointed if we didn't win the World Series within 3 years or so. You know, that went over my head. I didn't listen to that in one ear, out the other. However, I do think the direction of this organization will change, and it will start this off season. I hope.
Without going down a Carlos Beltran rabbit hole, Rich, I will say this. What gets lost in the fact that he got hired is the fact that there was a lot of bad blood, and the fact that it is the Wilpons, you know, maybe it was mutually beneficial at the present point of the time that Carlos Beltran got hired. However, there is something to be told about that, and it just gets completely forgotten about considering all the trauma afterwards.
Well, yeah, there is. And I think, you know, there will be changes for sure. And now, again, do they hang on to some of the vestiges of the Wilpon era? Because I think the Beltran bad blood is probably more with Sandy Alderson than anybody else, you know, because Sandy traded him, and that's what I'm thinking, you know, maybe there was a degree of that with the Wilpons as well, though he did agree to come back when the Wilpons are still the owners. So, and we know with the sweeping changes, which I do think will happen, and we all know the way this works, folks, you know, if they do bring in a new president of baseball operations, whether Sandy is there or not, whether they bring somebody in underneath him or Sandy steps aside because of all the, you know, in quotes, stuff that's gone on all over the place, you know that those people, we know the cascading of events. Those people tend to want to bring in their own people, which is reasonable. And yeah, maybe Carlos Beltran isn't someone who would even be in the conversation, because if it's a, you know, we'll throw out the name everybody's throwing out there, Theo Epstein. If it is him or anyone else, you'd have to think that Theo Epstein would want to bring someone in who he's comfortable with. he probably has no relationship with Carlos Beltran. So yeah, I think the future is exciting for the organization because of the new ownership and all that, but still, it's very uncertain because we don't know when that first domino is going to fall, and then from there, all the other dominoes will fall. So, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty at this point.
I will go here, if we're bringing up Theo Epstein once again. Mike, just to take some of the shine off the diamond, we do have to remember that I believe both the people – oh, God, and we, of course, we haven't even talked about this part yet, and now I'm just even reminding myself. But Theo Epstein should be brought up when it comes to both Zach Scott, I believe, but definitely Jared Porter. And he hired both of them, and with the Jared Porter stuff, I think all of the allegations happened under the Cubs' jurisdiction, quote unquote. So I, again, want to take some of the shine off the diamond, considering that I have been advocating for Theo Epstein. Sorry, Mike, that was directed your way.
Muted. What can I say? Those names are indeed, you know, associated with Theo Epstein, Zach Scott and Jared Porter. They worked for him. He recruited them. What more can you say? Be careful what you ask for, you know, when we want Theo Epstein. But he seems to want too much. He wants part ownership. And, you know, according to an article out there, I don't know, Cohen might entertain something like that. But I doubt it. I think that's just rumor and clickbait. But I don't know what else to say. You know, I want him to scour the earth for executives that don't currently work for the Mets. What more can I say?
Yeah, you know, basically I want to just remind myself that as much as I think, Rich, that somebody like Theo Epstein could bring some stability to the franchise, I did think that about Sandy Alderson as well, and to an extent he did, but there does still seem to be, with all parties involved that we're talking about, some I guess that's just the human condition, you know? You're not going to have, unless I guess it's Tom Brady, as people like to say, as much as I'm a Jets fan, like, you're not going to get perfection out of these guys. There just seems to be a lot of instability.
There is. And, you know, the Epstein, and the thing is, and with Sandy too, to be fair, who knew what and when, right? Those are the key questions. And you know, did Sandy, you know about Jared Porter? Who knows? I mean, we have to, in order to make a fair assessment, don't we kind of have to know that? You know, and if he did and went ahead and hired the guy, well, that's certainly one thing. But if he had, if this information came out after the guy was hired, and it was swiftly taken care of, it was very swiftly taken care of. He was dismissed pretty quickly when it came to light. But, you know, again, we have to be fair. I say we, you know, myself included, when we have these thoughts, same thing with Theo Epstein. And I get it. I mean, I get that if you say, look, you know, we've had basically nothing but a PR disaster in the last year, you know, between Porter, Zach Scott, of course, Daniel Alderson had no way of controlling that. But then all the stuff with David Newman, you know, and the kind of Mickey Callaway, you know, the institutionalized sexual misconduct, and then that seemed to be pervasive in the organization. I think we have to ask ourselves, to be fair, like, what did Sandy, did he not do anything when he had information? Or did he just not know that that happened? I mean, it happens, guys, you know. You all can hire anybody listening to this podcast, any one of us, if we own a business or in a hiring position, you could hire somebody, you do your background check, and then, you know, stuff comes up after that just wasn't available at the time. And, you know, so if you willfully ignored it, that's one thing. But if you did not know, that's something else. Would it make sense then to bring in Theo Epstein, who is also connected to these very same people who caused the PR disaster? Yeah, that's a very good point. And that may be why, maybe over and above Epstein's wanting a piece of control of the team, ownership of the team, that may be reason enough why he's not considered. You've heard the name Stearns. You've heard the name Nirender. So there are other people out there. I think Mike is right. I think you have to scour and figure out who your best choice is. But like I said earlier, a lot of choppy water ahead. You know, a lot of dominoes have to fall, and there are a lot of considerations. You know, there are, I think Steve Cohen and company will be exceedingly cautious about, you know, whom they bring in. And rightfully so, because, you know, you guys, we're all on Twitter. We all absorb the news. The LOL Mets stuff the past 2 weeks has been insane, you know, and I'm sure as a guy who, very successful businessman, possibly be enjoying this. So, yeah, he probably will be exceedingly cautious about his decisions and almost maybe even have to go, if there's any suspicion of anything about anyone, rule that person out, because this team really needs to be squeaky clean for a while.
Rich, I'll go with this, and it was a thought that I kind of spaced on earlier, but I want to bring back up now that I remembered it. With Steve Cohen, going back to the tweeting, that doesn't it kind of play into what you were talking about of him being a part of the fan, meaning that it's a, and that's kind of, again, you know, for better or worse, the weird thin line that he's presenting for himself right here, is that he's doing what fans do. To like there's other fans literally being like, so how about those people talking about Baez the other week, where are you now, man? Like, that's basically what he's doing, and it's exactly what you were talking about. And then I'm going to go back to you about our next topic.
Well, so let's look at Cohen's tweeting. Obviously I don't have every tweet memorized, nor am I pulling them up. But if you think about it, I'm thinking about some tweets during the when the Giants played the Mets at Citi Field last week, and you know those horrific games that other than the 8-0 game, the other two games that the Mets should have won both. You know, he would tweet things like "Let's win it here, come on." I mean, great. That's what we want as fans. The owner is into this, man. You know, he's living and dying with every pitch like we are. This is the greatest thing ever. And when he's funny, you know, like I loved his tweet about when somebody said you can't get anything around Citi Field. He said, no, that's not true. You can get your car fixed. That's hysterical. That's funny. Taking something we all know, and he's making a wisecrack that we've all made. How many times have you made? I made it many times. You know, yeah, it'd be nice to go to McFadden's, but I'm afraid that, you know, my tires are going to get stolen off my car in front of the chop shops. And we all make that joke. He made that joke. That's great. He's one of us. But then it just, you wonder what goes through his mind when he made his star players apologize for trolling the fans and did it himself within a week. It just, it's like, does he run something by a PR person before doing it? Because it certainly doesn't seem that way. You know, I just don't get it. I don't get how, I could see if it was 5 years later. This was less than a week later after he made his guys, I'll say it one more time, awkwardly stand in front of the media and apologize for trolling the fans. Then he does it himself. It's mind-boggling.
I hear where you're coming from, and I just wanted to present that angle to you. And where I want to go next is the offense, and I want to see where you want to start with it. So we've established that Lindor and Baez, when they are at their best, change the dynamic of this offense. Brandon Nimmo has now gone down, which, you know, with Jonathan Villar and Brandon Nimmo at the top of the lineup, it was just going crazy. And I guess you could probably say we've already seen what would happen, because maybe Nimmo is in the lineup somewhat if he doesn't pull his hamstring in the bottom, or the lineup is changed. Who knows? In that Saturday game. So where do you want to go? The Mets have been scoring a lot of runs lately. Of course, you could say that has to do with their opposition. But again, I go to win the game presented to you that day. The Mets were not performing this way against some opposition like this. Where do you also see, outside of Lindor, Baez, and the top of the lineup, where do you want to go with the offensive conversation?
Well, I'll say the same thing I've said on this podcast for years, which is I've never understood how a singular approach to offense makes sense, and especially the one that Sandy Alderson, you know, apparently permeated throughout the organization, that what we are to do, we're not going to go the other way. We're not going to try to beat the shift. We're going to try to hit the ball over the shift, hit the ball over the fence, blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, when you're relying on that type of offense, that, you know, all or nothing offense, and you're getting nothing, you look really bad doing it. So what I've seen over the past couple of weeks, and tell me if you've seen something else, they're stealing bases. Are they the 1985 Cardinals? No, they're not. They're not built that way. No team is built that way. They're not, you know, stealing four or five bases a game, but they're selectively taking their shots. It's been noted on the postgame show that when these guys have speed, you know, Nimmo when he's there, Lindor, even Conforto, and he stole his first base of the season, but even Conforto runs fairly well. So when these guys see an opportunity, they're taking it, which is great. Pete Alonso, the self-proclaimed, and I say that with a smile, best power hitter on the planet, goes the other way and drives in runs. Jeff McNeil, we've seen him come around a little bit because he stopped trying to pull the ball all the time. So what I'm saying is, could be wrong, but I think the awakening has come from, finally, a change in approach where, you know what, guys, my guess would be the conversations kind of go like this. You know what, guys? Yeah, we're built for power. We're built to hit the ball over the shift and all that. And if you have the opportunity, do that. But also, if there are runners on base, and you heard it from the players, from Todd Zeal, they're saying this. When there are runners on base, don't try to do too much. Take what – if it means going the other way and taking the single to drive in a runner, keep the line moving, do it. So I think what you've seen is this acceptance that it is okay. It's okay to take a single every now and then. It's okay to go the other way. You don't always have to try to hit the ball over the fence. Do it selectively. Be the talented hitter you are, and if that's what you can do in that at bat, do it. Don't feel like you have to do the same thing all the time, because that just puts pressure on you as a hitter. And I think that flexibility has led to the success, and I don't think I'm saying anything incredibly insightful. I've heard, you know, the professionals talking about this, but I totally buy into it. I really think that is what it is. And I'm going to point to this, okay, guys? And I've been wanting to say this on this podcast for just 2 weeks now. All right. Mets played the Giants a couple weeks ago. Giants lead the major leagues in home runs. They clearly score that way. That is their method of scoring. Think about, I think it was the last game of the series, when it was tied in the eighth inning. Darren Ruff, okay, who is not an opposite field hitter. He's a big dude, big power hitter. He's on there. He's like a, you know, bench player for them, but his game is big power hitter. If you remember the at-bat he had, I think it was in the top of the eighth, it was a pitch that was outside. He, like, took a hockey shot at it. He saw the right side was open. He slapped it through the right side. That clearly is not his game. That's not what's gotten him to the major leagues, but he saw an opportunity. He recognized that the game was on the line. It was a game situation. As Keith would say, there was a hole there that you could drive a Panzer division through. And he's like, you know what? I'm taking it. And he looked awkward as hell doing it, if you remember. Do you remember that? It was kind of like an inside pitch. He looked like he was taking a slap shot from the blue line, but he knew exactly what he was doing. And to me, you're seeing some of that with the Mets, and I think that's a part of why they've been successful.
Mike, take it away. Run with it.
Well, I agree with Rich, you know, and some of these guys, they're starting to percolate at the same time. Lindor's getting a little bit hot. Conforto's been heating up. you know, hopefully can continue this through the throughout the month. Pete Alonso's rounding out a good season. You know, and then we have to be thankful for the power being supplied by VR and Pilar. That's a bunch of home runs that we ordinarily wouldn't have had. And now that we got Baez, you know, the offense is going to be a little different. You know, we've only gotten a week to view these guys together. So, you know, I think the next 3 weeks will have something a little different in store. Again, the bats are heating up. The problem is that who anticipated that at this point, you know, our starting rotation would be Carlos Carrasco, Rich Hill, Tyler McGill, and, you know, Tawan Walker and Marcus Stroman. So, you know, we got our hands full. We got our hands full. But, you know, right now, the hitting isn't, you know, my top priority. Like I said at the beginning of the show, you know, this team needs to get in sync. The starting rotation and the bullpen and the hitting needs to get in sync. They've had a disjointed season where they're only getting one of the three or two of the three, not all three. This is the time for that. And, you know, the odds are probably in their favor if you're a gambler now.
Well, let's talk about the starting rotation real quick. You know, that's a great question, Rich. You know, Mike, actually, let's run with you a little bit more, Mike, with the starting rotation like you just talked about. And here's the thing. Jacob deGrom almost makes you forget how lucky you are that you have Jacob deGrom. However, I will say this, that it hasn't been the most devastating part of this loss of what we've been saying. You know, obviously, like you said about the not in sync, the offense, whenever they're going, the bullpen and the starting rotation can't get in sync. But generally speaking, the starting rotation, including a rookie in Tyler McGill, have not been the, you know, sometimes you forget how crippled it is, if that makes any sense. Do you understand at all what I mean?
Sure. You know, it's kind of wondrous that we're still in, you know, a positive standing. You know, don't forget, there's more names to add to this list. David Peterson, you know, but let's also not forget that we lost Jacob deGrom and Francisco Lindor together for a considerable amount of time. That put a dent into this season. You know, so there's a lot to it, a lot more than just what we're talking about here this evening.
Rich, starting rotation.
Well, when you think about it, the starting rotation has kept them in, even without DeGrom, has made them remain competitive. I saw a stat today, I don't have it in front of me, but that if you look at in the division, I mean, the Mets have, I believe they have this, within the teams in the National League East, I think they have the best starters ERA, the second best starters ERA, and the best team ERA. So clearly, although they're minus Jacob deGrom, they never had Syndergaard, and they're experiencing essentially with a blip in there for a couple of starts, a second half collapse by Tywan Walker, the pitching is still hanging in there. You know, looking at a couple of numbers here, these records are not good. You know, Stroman's only 9-12, but he has a 2.93 ERA. So he's obviously pitching really well. And you know, so Stroman has done a yeoman's work keeping them. I can't think of any Marcus Stroman start this year where the Mets were, you know, basically manhandled. He's kept them in. I'd say I can't think of a game that they were out of in his 29 starts. You know, again, Tywan Walker, great start. Kind of struggling a bit. McGill has had a couple of rocky outings, as we know. He's only 2-4. Carrasco has been pretty good. You know, he's had – they were talking about how they're going to try to maybe mess with his warm-up routine so his body doesn't think it's the first inning. He's had bad first innings, and he had that bad start against the Dodgers. But apart from that, he, you know, he went 7 against the Giants. You know, he's been decent. Rich Hill has yet to win a game as a Met, but, you know, when you get Rich Hill at 41 years old, you're getting what you expected. You're realistically expecting 5 innings per start. If you can go five innings, give up two or three runs, yeah, I know that's not great, but that's what you traded for. You didn't exactly trade for Tom Seaver in his prime. You knew what you were getting, and you're getting exactly that. So he keeps them in the games, and it's a long way of saying the pitching clearly is the reason why they find themselves at least in the conversation on September 6th, even without DeGrom. And let's also give some props. Maybe go in their next stand. Let's give some props to the bullpen too. Yesterday the bullpen pitched 4 1/3 innings of hitless ball, and I believe I saw in the telecast today, that's the first time in franchise history that the bullpen has gone that long without giving up a hit. So the bullpen, and I know it's hard to say today after the Diaz meltdown, but in general, the bullpen has been very good. Aaron Loop has been a savior. So the pitching has kept this team relevant. The starting pitching, as much as anything, and it's when you look at the numbers, again, the wins and losses don't add up, but these guys are. They're the reason the team is competitive.
That they are, when you really look at it. And that 9-0, of course, Stroman gave up three runs, but like you said, he keeps you in games. The bullpen was much more at fault for giving that 9-run historic, non-loss up. Excuse me. But it's still, that's another thing that I don't even necessarily want to get into, which is why that even though they've been winning, sometimes there's still something a little sour to everything. But I want to get into the Yankees, of course, because the Subway Series is coming up. It's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And, of course, the Yankees are also fighting for a playoff spot. But before that, Mike, I just have to say, the Mets have to sweep the Marlins, but let's not forget the Marlins are actually not a terrible home club. The Mets have a lot to do with that 3 out of 4. However, the Mets really just need to bring it. They have to make sure they're on top of this because the Marlins, as little fans as they can get sometimes, as much as we joke about it, they have been performing at home.
That they have, and the Marlins, we're talking about Mets hitting. Well, the Marlins can pitch. They have good young arms. Hitting is their problem. And that said, they've scored more runs than the Mets this season. But we got to get through the Marlins, and like I said, some of these bats are starting to percolate at the same time. As you say, Sam, we need a sweep. It's imperative. It's imperative that, they walk out of there no less than 2 out of 3. But even that, it's still not good enough. We need 3, and then we're going to head into that Yankee series.
So speaking of the Yankee series, let's get right into it as we approach the hour. Rich, it's hard not to come across what the Yankees are doing, even if you're not paying attention. If you are a Mets fan and you pay attention to Mets baseball, it just so happens that you're going to be talking to your neighbor, you're going to be listening to sports radio, what have you. You're probably going to be hearing about the Yankees. What have you heard, seen, all of the senses about the Yankees?
Well, it's interesting with the Yankees because they played way under expectations for a long time, basically into about mid to late July. And then they played at just an unconscious level. I mean, they're a good team, of course, but it's like, when the Braves went on and won 9 in a row at that point, yes, they were beating the Marlins, the Nationals, and the Orioles, but it just doesn't work like that. No team is that good. So they had a natural correction. Well, the Yankees, yes, like I said, they're a good team, but they're having a natural correction now. They lost 2 out of 3 of the Orioles, which is a bit shocking. They had lost 6 of their last 8 coming into today, so you don't have to be a mathematician to know that they've lost 7 of their last 9 after losing to the Blue Jays. So Gary Cohen says, and I think it's a fair point, that it's perhaps possible, if not likely, that when the Mets play the Yankees this weekend, the Yankee team might feel a bit more like the team that the Mets beat up in July, 4th of July weekend, when they were kind of downtrodden. So that's basic. The Yankees seem to run hot and cold. which makes sense. You know, it's like I said earlier about the home run offense, although I guess they've stolen the most bases in the in baseball since the All-Star break, but they still do rely on the long ball. And when those hitters go cold, then, you know, then that's when they struggle. And, of course, they've had some injuries. Loaisig is out. So, watch. Loaisig is out. So and they've had some injury issues. So by the time they show up at Citi Field, I believe they play 17 of their next 20 in New York, of course, counting the three at Citi Field. And I think I'm not sure if you saw it, but Brett Gardner said it's okay going to Citi Field because we get extra energized for those games. Okay, that's fine. But that's what I'm seeing with the Yankees is, you know, they're in a slump now. They were playing unconsciously good baseball for a while, for about a month. They're in a bit of a slump now. Their hitters aren't hitting as they normally do. Look, if the Orioles can take 2 out of 3, the Mets took 2 out of 3 from them at the stadium in early July. It's not going to be like playing the Triple A Nationals again, that's for sure. But, you know, there's no excuses, man. You know, you've got to go out there and you've got to beat them. And it'll be an emotional weekend of the September 11th game on Saturday, of course, will be. Then they have Sunday Night Baseball on Sunday. So I don't want to say it's going to be a fun weekend because nothing around 9/11 could be fun, but I think it'll be a, an intense weekend. And what's most interesting is that both teams need these games desperately. You know, the Yankees and the Red Sox, of course, we know if the season ended today, they played the one-game playoff. And really, they're going back and forth between whether a game would be at Fenway or Yankee Stadium. They're kind of flip-flopping between the first and second wild card position. So the Yankees will definitely need the game. The Mets are fighting for their lives. So there's a lot going on this weekend.
A lot going on for sure. You have been listening to the Metsian podcast. Mike, the Yankees, you know, Bensonhurst talks. What do you see in here?
Well, they got a firm grip on the wild card, that's for sure. It's funny how the Tampa Bay Rays continue to win. Chaim Bloom is no longer with the organization, yet they lead the division with an 87-51 record, 8.5 games over the Yankees. That being said, you know, like Rich said, for the first 3 months, the Yankees kind of floundered along, you know, and then they perked up in August. They went over 20 games. They went 21-9, I believe. Let me bring that up real quick. Sorry about that. 21-8 in August, and they won 13 games in a row. But as of late, you know, as Rich also pointed out, you know, they've been on a losing streak. They've lost a whole bunch of games. So, you know, after Gerrit Cole, I think their starting rotation is very questionable. They have a great bullpen. The hitting has been suspect again, strikeout or nothing. Giancarlo Stanton has been really heating up. He's tearing the leather off the baseball lately. So when he's going well, the Yankees go well, you know, because you're going to get what you're going to get out of Aaron Judge. And, you know, the other players, they've also dealt with their share of injuries, you know, and so far the reinforcements where they came in with the flash and a bang, you know, they've kind of leveled out since their acquisitions. And, you know, the Yankees got their hands full. They're playing Toronto, and then, as you guys mentioned, we play them next week. It'll be an emotional weekend for sure.
And before we get into the 20th anniversary of 9/11, because I do want to get into that, because it looks like, Rich, the next time that we'll be able to speak is going to be September 16th, just based off of the way we do these podcasts. And the Cardinals games, Rich, the Cardinals are right there in the thick of it trying to sneak up, I believe, in front of the Mets. And I'll pull these up while you're speaking, but the standings. There's a lot of, shall I, you know, dare say, meaningful September games coming up for the Mets and their opponents.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. You know, and if you look at Padres are off today, but, you know, they have the second wild card at the moment. Reds are right in there. Cardinals are right in there. They're all ahead of the Mets, as are the Phillies, of course. The Phillies are ahead of the Mets in the division, so naturally they're ahead in the wild card as well. So there, yeah, there's a lot of there are a lot of teams that are alive, particularly in the National League. And so what's unfortunate for the Mets, and again, no excuses, but what's unfortunate for the Mets is they're playing a lot of them coming up. You know, when you look at the schedule, like we talked about, after the Marlins, you have the Yankees who need these games. Not that they would go easy on the Mets anyway, but they definitely need these games. I believe they have a 3.5 game lead on Oakland for the what would be the second wild card spot. So while they are 3.5 ahead, and that's fairly comfortable with 5 games to go, you know, it's not like they have a 10-game lead, so they do need the game. Then after that, you know, the Mets play the Cardinals, which is going to be a head-to-head battle. They're jockeying for position for the wild card. And the Mets can't forget about that. You know, you have the division. They have two avenues to get to the playoffs, so the Cardinals are right there. Then think about this, guys. After the Cardinals, you know, the Mets have to play the Phillies, who are right in front of them for the division and the wild card. And then it doesn't get any easier. They play the Red Sox for two games. The Red Sox need the games as much as the Yankees need these games this weekend. And then, lo and behold, they go to Milwaukee. Well, Milwaukee, I'm hoping, will have the division just about clinched by then. So we'll see how that plays out. Then after Milwaukee, you have those pesky Marlins again, and then you have the Braves. So what I'm getting at is, The Mets, of their remaining 24 games, only 6 of them are against teams that we could say for sure won't have postseason on the line, something about postseason on the line when they get there. And that's, you know, that means 18 of 24 games will be played against teams that have a postseason interest in the games. And that's daunting. Now, for those of us who were around in 1973, it was the same way. You know, they were coming down the stretch where everybody was in it until basically the last weekend. So they just have to suck it up and win these games. It's going to be hard. But you know what? They put themselves in the spot. They had a nice first-place lead, lost that lead, and here they find themselves.
Here we find ourselves with potential comparisons to 1973. Mike, before we get to any final word, I'll segue over to you with wherever you want to go from there.
That's it. You got to believe. Again, if back in April we haggled over this and we said the Mets would be 4 games out on September 7th, you know, or heading into September 7th, a lot of people would have subscribed to that. So, you know, they have to make their way. They have to win these games until we hit those divisional matchups against the Phillies and the Braves. Make their way. That's it. Win or lose. You know, and the final chapter on the season will be written, and we'll give it a review after the season, and we'll see where we go from there.
That we will. And once more, ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and we're so thankful you do. Once more, if you are listening to us live, you're, of course, listening to the website, but there are plenty of ways for you to listen to us. Please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find podcasts, Google Play. And if, again, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, let us know wherever you can find us on the Blog Talk Radio, the email on there, on Twitter, wherever you can find us. Let us know if there's somewhere that you want us to make sure you can listen to the Metsian podcast. We want to make sure that you can. The final word, ladies and gentlemen, going to Rich Spirago first. Go ahead, man.
Perspective is my final word because, Sam, I went to the game last Saturday on August 28th. When I walked into Citi Field, they were 8.5 out. It looked for all the world like the night before when they had lost to Washington 2-1 that their season was over. And if you would have told me, okay, look, on August 28th it was 8.5 out. On September 6th they're 4 out, I would have signed for that with any hand I possibly could have found. You know, I would have signed for that in blood. That sounded great. But the other part of the perspective is, and while they're 8-3 against the Nationals and Marlins, which is also good, they have no margin for error. So you can look at it as they've done well to get to this point. They've just got to keep pushing. Or you could look at opportunity. It's all a matter of perspective. That's my final word.
I like it. Thank you, Rich. Mike, go ahead. Michael Colon.
Well, as we mentioned, next week is, you know, 20th anniversary of 9/11. I worked there for 2 years. I haven't been there since. Kind of torn if I should go back this year or not. I'm in conflict. But 20 years later, my heart still goes out to all those people. Being that we won't speak by then, you know, I lost two friends in there. So I wish all the families well. You know, there's a story circulating about the two children who are now grown who lost their father in the accident. So my heart goes out. And like I said, maybe shoot me a tweet and try to convince me one way or the other. Like I said, I worked there for 2 years. I was up close to it. I smelt it. And I haven't been there since. I haven't been anywhere near there since. Anywhere nearer than the Battery Tunnel. That's the closest I've been there. And I don't know what to do in the upcoming week. So God bless us all.
God bless. And yeah, thank you for reminding me, considering I went to the final word, completely spacing on my words from earlier. But Rich, I'll go to you after my comments. I was on the bus. I remember exactly at 8:46. I was 16 years old, and I was on a city bus going from 46th Street on 10th Avenue, turning into Amsterdam, going to 65th Street. And I didn't find out about anything until second period Italian class, when the teacher got word on whatever device she had, you know, phone or whatnot, about everything. And I think at that point, by that period, after 9:06, I believe, time that the second plane hit, 9:07 maybe, I believe it had been past this when I had heard about it when I was in second period. So even though I was late, I remember that day. And being on the bus at 8:46, I had been late to be there. And I was in the basement all day. So my friend was describing things to me, and he said, you know, basically the buildings are gone. And he kind of said it nonchalantly. I was like, what do you mean the buildings are gone? And I couldn't believe him. And he's like, I said, they're not there anymore. And he's like, no, they're not there anymore, Sam. And it wasn't until after, with like fluctuations of hearing it on the radio, we never had television the entire day. Parents maybe needed to come pick up the kids, but because my school had people within the five boroughs going there, that was kind of going to be impossible. So eventually they let kids out, and, you know, I actually ended up bumping into my other mother, who was coming to meet me and coming to pick me up. And that's when I went home and finally saw the pictures, probably sometime 4 p.m, saw the video and pictures. So that's my memory of it. And it's crazy to me that that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I missed it by minutes. I was in the city on the 10th, spent the night there on the 10th. Remember, it was an amazing electrical storm, just a ridiculously bad thunderstorm that night. Giants, Broncos. Remember watching
that's
that
right.
Monday Night Football. That's right. And so, what I did, I had a meeting in Philadelphia the next day, right on the 11th. So, I went and got my coffee at the Starbucks on 2nd, and I believe it's 88. It's in the 82nd. Got my coffee. Drove down to the Lincoln Tunnel, went out the Lincoln Tunnel, got on the Jersey Turnpike going down to Philly. I'm assuming the timing on that, that I went through the tunnel right about 8:30. And so you come out of the tunnel, you get on the Jersey Turnpike. And so I'm guessing that if I had looked to my left, I would have seen it, but I just didn't. You know, I'm driving straight ahead, going down to Philly. And I turned the radio off. I'll never forget this. I was Q1043 was my radio station. I wasn't into the music they were playing for whatever reason. put a CD in for the drive, got down to Philly, got to this meeting, get to the hotel where the meeting is around, like, you know, 10:30 or so. I think the meeting started at 11. And I go to the room. I see where my company's meeting is, and there's nobody in the room. And I'm like, what, did they cancel this thing? What? And I drove all the way down here. And then I saw everything was weird. Like, there was nobody around. I saw somebody who said, don't you know what's going on? I mean, if the Twin Towers were hit. And then everybody who was at the meeting was in this room with a TV, and as were other hotel guests, you know, hotel staff. Everybody was in this big room watching TV, and that's my memory of it. And I remember I couldn't go back because you couldn't get into the city for a few days. So I ended up having to spend, you know, 3 or 4 nights in Philly. And then I remember when I was driving back, as you start to see Manhattan, just seeing the smoke for, you know, 3 or 4 days later, still smoke coming up. And, yeah, that's my 9/11 story. Incredible. And then all the stuff that happened after, of course, you know, and let's not hesitate to mention the role baseball had in that. You know, we all know that the Mets did a great job. I mean, the Yankees did too. They donated a lot of money. The Mets did a great job with the staging site at Shea Stadium with, you know, Bobby V was, of course, heavily into it, as were the players. And then they came back a week later on the Tuesday following, on the 18th. They played a 3-game series in Pittsburgh. I remember President Bush saying he thought it was very important that baseball got back to it. He thought it was part of the healing process. He encouraged it, and baseball started playing a week later. And you know, then, of course, we know about the whole thing with the Braves and the Piazza home run. So, yeah. Incredible that it was 20 years ago.
Incredible, and I love the segue for me because the night before, one, you talked about that electrical storm, and my dad and I, for all of you out there, I'm a converted Mets fan from Yankees, and my dad and I in 2001 were going to the game with our season tickets. We passed these, let's assume they're from Staten Island, so they were leaving early. But it was a father and 2 sons who were adult age. And they were like, yeah, they haven't called it yet, but we're not going to wait around to see it. And we actually got up and sat there for maybe like 10, 20 minutes before they called it. Roger Clemens was supposed to pitch. And then the next morning, you know, as I, you know, told, you know, and it's crazy. Like you said, baseball had such a role to play. And going to that game, Mike, you know, it seems that there was no real energy in the stadium, but Liza Minnelli singing New York, New York kind of gave it a little bit of a jolt in that Mets-Braves game, September 21st. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, you know, people were apprehensive to demonstrate any kind of joy. But, you know, those were human emotions pouring out. You can't stop that. That's the human element. And it was beautiful. It really was. And it's funny, not necessarily that game, although how special it was. Baseball is intertwined in my memory of 9/11 as well, but through the Brooklyn Cyclones, actually. Because in 2001, they were playing for the championship. They won the first game in Wilmington. That series was the best 2 out of 3. And game 2 was coming to Coney Island that Tuesday evening. And they suspended the game then to be played, and they declared Wilmington and Brooklyn co-champs. And I will never forget that. Because at the time that news started breaking on the radio, I was reading the paper, and that's what was on my mind going to the game that night. And you know, that day and the Brooklyn Cyclones will ever remain together, hooked, locked together in my memory. So, yeah, as we say, you know, baseball mimics life and life mimics baseball. Sometimes they join together at the hip.
And especially in this city, and Carlo Erskine has long talked to me about just the welcoming when he came to talk to the firemen in both Brooklyn and Manhattan, who just literally picked him up at the airport, just sent somebody to pick him up. That's what baseball meant to them too. And like you said, it with this city especially, there's no way that it could play out without it. And I guess that can just lead to final word that I guess I'll go with cherish. And not to, you know, just like to bring levity at the same time. Cherish is a word I use to describe my final word. Just cherish every moment, cherish life, and just soak it up and take it in. And who cares whether Edwin Diaz blew a save today? You know, I guess, like, as we talk about all of this, that it's meaningless yet so meaningful at the same time. Cherish and cherish those feelings. Don't have those feelings get ugly. Be disappointed, of course, that Edwin Diaz blew the save, but still cherish those moments, because in the end, it doesn't at all matter. Of course we want the Mets to make the playoffs, and of course we will cry throughout the playoffs as the Mets go through it. But in the end, if the ball goes by Daniel Murphy, you chuckle as you go home and just think about all different ways it could have played out, it did play out, other moments in history that compare or contrast with it. That's just the experience. That's just the soap opera. That's just the drama. So that's my final word. And I always end with let's go Mets, but considering that I have tears in my eyes, I will pass once more around to my guys, my compadres in this endeavor of ours. I love you all. I love the two of you. And Mike, do you have anything else to say?
Well, it's time that everyone learns how to get along with each other, even though they disagree over certain things. That used to be the norm. Right now, it's out of whack. It's okay to disagree, and it's still okay to be friends. That's it. Let's learn how to get along again.
Precisely. Rich?
Yeah, and let's remember that, I know this is going to sound cliche, but let's remember that sports is so insignificant in the scope of life. You know, you think about it, right? It's like everything we've been talking about. And I know we say things like this all the time, but we get all wrapped up in it. We talk about it, but let's keep the fact that this is a fun thing and that it's a distraction from real life. And none of life in itself isn't guaranteed. So sports, I mean, my God, you know, to get crazy about it and, you know, like Mike said, vehemently and vitriol disagree with people and just get ugly over it when life itself is so precious and not tomorrow, as we know, isn't guaranteed. It's just it's insanity. So I know I do it sometimes, but it's a good reminder that this is a fun thing, and let's just be thankful that we're all on the earth and we all have the opportunity to engage in this fun thing and keep perspective. And even whether it's politics or whatever it is, it's like Mike said, it's okay to disagree. It always was. For some reason, it became not okay. I don't know, 10 years ago, whatever it was, it became not okay to disagree. Well, it is okay to disagree. So just always be respectful of people and cherish what we have.
Thank you both. Cherish what we have. Be respectful. Have perspective. You gotta believe, and let's go Mets. We'll see you at the next game, everybody, and we'll see you on the 16th. Take care. Thank you, guys. Thanks, audience.
Good night.
Take care.
All right.
Good night,
bye
all.
Now.